Sunday, July the 3rd, 1983. This is an attempt to put down on tape some of the things which transpired at my session of the New Dimensions in Sound seminar organized by Extension Studies in Wellington earlier this year. The reason I'm taping this is because I've run into great difficulty in putting down in any kind of coherent way in writing, first of all, what happened, and secondly, in a more general way, my thoughts about some of the topics that you mentioned in your letter, Julian. First of all, a brief description of what happened at that seminar. I first of all played a complete work, a piece for tape, four-channel piece called Edit for Pauline. It was a work based on an interview made by Colleen Anstey of a patient of hers, she's a nurse, who suffers from multiple sclerosis. And the work is uses this interview. In the interview, Pauline, the multiple sclerosis sufferer, describes how she attempted to commit suicide through taking sleeping pills. She explains the reasons why she did this and how she feels about not succeeding. I used the tape because I found it a very moving document. The tone of the woman, Pauline, when she talks about her attempt is quite dispassionate and sometimes even humorous. Also, the quality of her voice impressed me a great deal. She has a slight speech impediment because of the onset of a disease onto her throat and jaw. She is completely paralyzed from the neck down. Also, I think I wanted to make the piece for other reasons. It's very difficult when one describes one's motives for making a piece because you don't know whether, in fact, you're just making them up, looking for motives and producing them, or whether you are actually locating real sort of triggers, creative triggers, that actually did exist. However, there's very little one can do about that. I think it's up to whoever's interpreting a document like this as to what they make of that. The initial recording was made by Colleen and for a piece that she was doing, a sculptural performance work, and was used by her in that piece which she performed in Wellington in November of 1982. She didn't treat the interview in any way. She did other things quite unrelated to the interview. Colleen had been treating Pauline for quite some time, and often when she comes back from a night on the district, she's a district nurse, she describes to me interactions that she's had with patients, and it became clear to me that she had a particular kind of relationship with Pauline. She admired her, I think, a great deal, and although Pauline was difficult, very difficult, with other nurses and other staff and with Colleen sometimes. I think Colleen responded to this. And I think that also was one of the reasons why I became interested in the work. Pauline obviously represented something for Colleen, and through my discussions about Pauline with Colleen, she came to represent something for me too. And when it became clear that I was going to make a work from the recording, I felt I needed to get her permission. And so an appointment was prepared by Colleen for me to go and see Pauline, and Colleen and I went to see her together. I've only met her once. It was a fairly unsatisfactory kind of meeting in the sense that nothing happened. And that's interesting because I obviously expected something to happen. I was surprised by her actual physical appearance. She was much smaller and slighter than I expected. Her voice gave me a sense of tremendous strength, sort of bigness. And we just sort of conversed about general mundane things and watched some television. I met her two sons, they were in the house at the time. But I think the meeting was important, and she certainly gave her consent for the interview to be used. I don't know how far her actual personal medical condition and situation, human situation, prompted the work. It certainly prompted it initially. And I started off by just doing normal editing procedures on the tape, transferring it from cassette to reel, editing out Colleen's voice. And it was in the process of this editing that I, for some reason or other, became aware of the fact that the machines that I was using to do the editing were making noises. I've used the mechanical sounds of tape recorders in earlier pieces, in a piece called Parade, which was my previously completed work for tape. I've used the on-off mechanism of the tape recorder in the work, unsuccessfully, I think. And so it was obviously in my mind. But for some reason, I realized that at that point, that the clue to the structure of the work lay in the editing process itself. I didn't follow any further the relationship between the editing process and the content of the interview. I still don't know what that relationship is, if there is any at all. But I felt that the working, the editing process's effects on the narrative of the interview had something to do with what I wanted to say about how I felt about Pauline and her condition. And so initially I set up contact microphones on the machine I was doing the editing on, and on the table and the splicing block, and I just edited the whole tape from beginning to end and recorded the whole thing. The sounds that were on the tape and the sounds that were coming from the process that I was undertaking. This left me with a piece that lasted about an hour long. The actual interview lasts for 10 minutes. It was a very long piece, and nothing happened in it. All that happened was at certain points in the narrative was interrupted by an external noise, the sound of the tape recorder, and then the sounds, the resonance of the room, sounds of me breathing and moving around and editing the tape, and then the tape would start again. Those sounds would disappear and the narrative would continue. And at first I thought that this was the piece, because I rationalized that the frustration and intense irritation that was produced by these interruptions, some of which lasted up to 2 or 3 minutes in length, the editing process, would make an audience would enable an audience, force an audience to experience the same kind of situation and state that Pauline experiences all the time. Not being able to control her environment, not being able to even kill herself. And I felt I'd struck a form which was very intricately linked with the material. And for a number of weeks after that, I was sure that that was the piece. For some reason or other, I then realized that, well, I'm still not absolutely certain whether that wasn't the piece and shouldn't have been left at that stage. However, I didn't leave it at that stage. I then had in my mind right from the beginning the idea of the editing process being done as a performance in front of an audience, so that they could hear what was on the tape and they could also hear and see those operations being performed. This, I felt, would make the irritation more strong. I think probably I was wrong in that feeling, actually, now in retrospect. So, for some reason or other, I decided to telescope the narrative so that instead of it being just a single linear narrative from beginning to end, the various sections that I'd produced, sandwiched between the editing process sounds, I decided to layer them in a sort of an exponential fashion so that the piece was linear to start with and then grew quite suddenly and very steeply into a very deep contrapuntal layering of narrative and editing sounds. And this is what I engineered, and that became the first section of the work. However, in the process of working on a performance of the work, I began to discover other ritual tasks that I might undertake during the editing process. They began as me reiterating in the microphones the last words that Pauline would say before I made an edit. In other words, locating verbally the end of each narrative section. Then I decided that I would write these down on a blackboard. Then I decided to contact microphone the blackboard. And this produced what I felt were sounds which reinforced the general overall feeling of urgent frustration, which I felt was in the narrative. Then I decided to, instead of putting blank leader tape in between each section, I was marking the end of one of the narrative and the beginning of the editing sounds with a small piece of blank leader. I decided to interpolate pre-recorded material relating to Pauline, basically a discussion that I'd tape recorded earlier between Colleen and I relating to Pauline's condition and Colleen's attitude towards Pauline and my attitude towards Pauline. And so I cut up this tape into varying lengths, put them on small reels, made a small stand, clamped it onto the editing desk and contact microphoned that, so that every time I pulled tape from the reel, it made a very loud sound. I then pre-recorded the live sounds that I was making. I pre-recorded the reel sound, the tape being pulled off the reel. I pre-recorded other sounds. As I worked towards a ritual that I could do each time I made an edit in the performance version of the work, I stumbled across various other things. One of them being, I decided to transfer water from one receptacle to another, brass receptacles they were, because in the narrative, Pauline describes how she transferred water from a large receptacle into the glass with the 100 sleeping tablets in it, with a straw. strawful by strawful until the glass was full and the tablets had been dissolved and she drank it down with the straw. So I transferred water from one receptacle to another with a straw in between each edit to kind of mark the each editing procedure section. Then I found that the bowl that I was transferring the water into made a beautiful sound. And then when I was well into the production of the work, I had an experience which is quite corny but actually very true, and this actually did happen, I'm not making this up. I went to a performance of the National Orchestra in the Town Hall, and they played fairly light stuff, amongst which was a performance of Romeo and Juliet by Tchaikovsky. I hadn't been to a good orchestral concert for a long time, and I was very moved in a very positive way by the optimistic nature of the whole experience, really. The orchestra making beautiful sounds, sounds that had been made beautiful by a composer, and the audience reacting in a very positive way. The whole thing being very in control and very buoyant. And I felt very strongly during the performance that I wanted to, that I felt compassion for Pauline. I didn't just want to present in as brutal a way as possible her condition. I also wanted to make a statement of my own personal compassion for her, which I realized I felt very strongly. So I went straight out to the studio the next evening and hummed a long note through a microphone onto tape, changing the shape of my mouth in the process and producing harmonics, what I call multiphonics. I then dropped that hum 2 octaves and finished up with what I call the chant, a basic, turns out to be a B-flat note or chord, which I worked on for a long time, trying to make it as fundamental a sound as I possibly could. I then tuned electrical oscillators in triads, tracing the harmonic series on the fundamental I'd hummed, multi-layered those a number of times on an 8-track tape recorder, and mixed them into the basic chant, filtered them, so that I produced what I felt was a very primal, fundamental, but tonal element. And when I mixed that with the editing sounds, I knew I had something more than I had with either one or the other. Then I was faced with the problem of how to integrate this very, very, very different element. And the idea of doing the work in performance helped me solve this. Because in performance, task operations can be undertaken with it as a juxtapositional lateral kind of element in a work. That often happens in sculptural performance. And so I realized that I could hum this note any time I liked. Actually hum it while I was doing the editing process. So what happened in the end was, as each edit came along, I stopped the tape recorder, wrote the last words that she'd said on the blackboard, went to the brass bowls and transferred water with a straw, sounded the brass bowl, and from the note of the brass bowl pitched the B flat with my voice, hummed it, and continued to hum it as I went back to the tape deck, took the tape off the deck, and spliced it on the splicing block. And that was the ritual task that I did every time I did a splice. this seemed to work for me. Then I began to work just with the sounds that I'd produced from the task operations. The brass bowl sound, the humming sound, the editing sounds, the sound of the blackboard being written on, and the sounds of the reels of extra tape being pulled off and spliced and interpolated into the narrative. This produced another two sections of more musical material without any editing sounds in it at all. And for a long time I was very badly stuck as to how I could integrate these three elements together without either producing an enormously long work or producing contrivances and anomalies which weren't satisfactory. There was a deadline looming, that was the New Dimension Seminar, but I was very certain that if I didn't have the work completed by the time I was to leave for Wellington, then what I intended to do was to take all the contributing tapes with me and show why I hadn't been able to complete the piece yet, which I thought might have been quite interesting, if not what was really required. However, I forced through to a solution which I feel works, and I knew it worked as soon as I'd done it. And strangely enough, the mechanism for finding the solution is one which has happened to me before. And when this particular kind of mechanism works, I always recognize it as being the best sort. It hasn't happened very often to me. Most of the works that I've completed are flawed badly. This one I'm sure is too, but not fundamentally flawed like most of the other ones are that I've made. I was faced with a long section of editing material, the narrative slowly being drowned in succeeding layers of extra narrative and editing sounds, humming and bell sounds and so on, building to a very, very intense act of dynamic texture. How was I to get from that to a pure statement of the chant material and a more musical manipulation of some of the noise sounds that were actually in the editing process of the first section? And it occurred to me that what I should do is just put the machine at a certain point, put all the tape recorders into fast forward with the edit mode on, so that the tape sounds suddenly took off, raced into high frequency and disappeared, and all that was left was the sound of the motors of the tape recorders. Fade that into silence, and then, and as it turned out, into the beginning of the next section. I did this, and I was worried that it would seem to be a very corny and contrived thing to do. I think, in fact, it fits the whole idea of layered realities that actually the work is about at one level. So the first section disappears up the chimney from the frequency point of view. One is catapulted from inside the machine, from the playback heads of the machine, from the material that has been fixed on the tape, to the actual machine that is doing the playing, that is actually enabling those signals to be transferred and transformed into sounds. And one hears them, not what they're playing. And that is the transition and catalyst to a more musical presentation, the sort of Tchaikovsky part of the work. So, and in the second section, I actually dovetailed the two sections that I'd had left and telescoped them and manipulated them for a long time very carefully until I got them in just the right order so that the second section was the right length. and it had the kind of emotional curve that I required. I think Edit for Pauline is a typical case of me being fascinated by a very human situation, and then the sound and mechanical sort of behavioural almost characteristics of making the piece taking over the work and producing the formal answers necessary. So that the content, the actual content and narrative of the suicide became less and less and less and less important. And the way in which that content was manipulated more and more important. I think if you substituted other material, or if you listened to the work and you didn't understand the English language, it would still work as a piece. I hope so. Also, I think it's symptomatic of a growing awareness in me of the documentary nature of tape music. I think for myself that's the era, the way that it's going for me. I've always been an avid listener of Spectrum documentaries on the radio, and I find them very moving sometimes and very skillful. Perhaps Edit for Pauline is a sort of a souped-up Spectrum. I hope it's more than that. I hope it's an actual piece of music. I think of it as music. But I also think of it in one sense as a sound document. A manipulation of a social record in such a way that the various emotional facets of that record are put forward in a positive way. There are obviously various levels of reality that work in this piece. If one just listened to the narrative, then one would just hear the narrative and that is all. As soon as the narrative is interrupted by an editing sound, by the tape recorder that's playing the narrative being heard to stop, then the narrative itself moves back a step in dimension, as it were. It goes into the background, and the machine comes into the foreground. Then, and in the performance of this work, I'm seen to produce the sound of the tape recorder stopping. But after a while, tape recorder stopping sounds are heard while I'm doing something else, so that then the machine goes back into the background and becomes a recording rather than an actuality. I've been thinking a lot over the last couple of years of the relationship between magnetic tape recordings of things like that and photographs, particularly Robin Morrison's book, New Zealand from the Road, the South Island from the Road, which I think is a marvellous example of social, cultural, if you like, record seen through a particular kind of aesthetic keyhole, actually transcending any kind of social record or including it, embracing it in an artistic statement.